Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 21, Bhagavad Gita for Dummies. Reclaiming Christianity is sponsored by our Patreons. If you would like to support this podcast, please check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where the host doesn't wear pants. I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy. I am no one of consequence. If you would like to talk back, the whole point of this podcast is that we have a conversation. If you'd like to talk back to me, please check it out at reclaimingchristianity.net or send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. So this episode of Reclaiming Christianity, we've been 3 weeks on a book club, and we've been talking about the same book, What is the Bible, by Rob Bell. We've been talking about that for 3 weeks and with different panel members, and I've got another type of panel here for you today. I have a couple friends from the Hindu Temple of Central Indiana, and we're going to talk about the Bhagavad Gita. So let me introduce them to you a little bit. First off is Indu Vasudevan. Indu, go ahead and introduce yourself. So the way the podcasts work is we only have audio. We don't have anything to do to differentiate people with other than audio. So why don't you tell just a little bit about yourself, Indu?
Okay, my name is Indu Vasudevan, and I've been a resident of Indianapolis now for more than 25 years. I was born in India. I was raised a Hindu. And I think I feel like my faith helps me understand myself better, helps me understand other people better, and it's given me kind of a structure in which I can grow. So I think that's one thing many people ask is, why are you Hindu? And I think it's partly because I was born Hindu.
Well, that would be the same answer for just about anybody when you ask them, why are you that religion?
Right.
I mean, that's a big part of it is because that's where you're born.
But the other thing is that I feel like this is a faith that allows me to grow in a purposeful way.
Excellent. So you do a lot of interfaith work in the Indianapolis area. Why do you do interfaith work?
I think I believe that, and what I've seen, what I see when I'm speaking to my friends of different faiths, is that what we really believe is the same thing. And I would like to help people understand how much we have in common. And also, I'd like to have people understand that the differences that may seem huge are not that huge, really. But those differences are also part of the charm of life on Earth. I don't think you can look at God's creation and not understand that God delights in diversity. So I like that we share so much in common, but I also love the feeling that the things that make us different are also things that are beautiful and beloved.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. So I first met Indu doing some interfaith work. So before I had this podcast, I had a YouTube channel. And in fact, the YouTube channel is still up if you want to go take a look at it. It's called Through the Eyes of the Other. And it was my start of exploring other faiths, different viewpoints, different ideologies than what I was brought up with and I've known most of my life. Maybe you call it my midlife crisis. That's okay if you want to call it that. But this is on YouTube, Through the Eyes of the Other. And I was just very, very taken by Indu with her storytelling capacity. And so I'm going to hopefully be able to have some opportunity for Indu to tell some stories a little bit later on, not to put you on the spot or anything, but she's just a wonderful, wonderful person. So, and I have just met our second panelist is Venkat Raman. Did I say that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. And you are Indu's father?
Yeah.
Okay. So Venkat, what does Hinduism mean to you? Why are you Hindu and what do you love about Hinduism?
The answer is same as what Indu gave. I was born as a Hindu.
Uh-huh.
And for a long time, I wondered why there should be so many religions.
Hmm.
And then it really bothered me. But then I found when I started looking into each religion very carefully, I found that as Hindu noticed, there is a lot that unifies us and very little doctrines that are different.
Yeah.
Actually, many of these differences are exaggerated. I think they can be easily overcome, and then we can live in harmony.
Yeah. We're very good. In American culture, we're very good at pointing out our differences. I mean, we can see the differences very, very easily, and we like to split ourselves up into red and blue and Christian and Muslim and so many different things. And we like to point out our differences, but the similarities are just absolutely striking. I mean, that's what you two have talked about. That's really what I have found since really exploring other faith paths other than my own. I think it's fantastic. There are many, many things. Many more things that make us similar than make us different. So some of you are listening to this right now and you're going, what the heck am I listening to? What's going on? Because this has been a podcast about Christianity so far, and now he's talking about Hinduism. So let me explain that a little bit. Why explore Hinduism? Why explore Bhagavad Gita? So those of you that know, the reason that I have the podcast, why I call it Reclaiming Christianity, is because I believe that especially in this country, in the United States, especially evangelical Christianity, has largely lost the plot. And I think that we've gone down roads that are not necessarily Christian roads, and in many ways Christian ends up being a political label than a religious label, and that really, really bothers me. And so I want to do in some small part, I want to help recapture that. And in evangelical Christianity, we're really big in conversion. We want to say, oh, you need to be a part of us. You need to be one of us. You need to be a Christian. You need to meet Jesus Christ. You need to be. So why don't you two talk? What is conversion? Is there such a thing as conversion, getting people to be a Hindu in Hinduism? Does that exist?
No, we don't have any process for conversion, partly because we believe that everyone is headed for the same destination. We are all destined to be one with God. It doesn't matter what faith tradition you belong to. I think Swami Vivekananda, I think I mentioned him to you previously, John, but he said, we are all rivers flowing to the same ocean. Mm. So there's no purpose to conversion. The other thing I think that as Hindus, we tend to feel that, you know, there is a huge value in what we call the satsang, the community of people who are seeking the truth. And having that community around you, having that support, having that guidance, it's not a substitute for the experience of unity, but it helps you. And what happens when you convert is that you kind of cut yourself off from that community.
Yeah.
And you may establish a new community, but then you always have this sense of severance, which you shouldn't have.
Yeah.
So, you know, we, a long time ago when I was in college, I remember I was in the student union, and these two young ladies came and sat down next to me and said, have you read the book of John?
Uh-huh.
And I said, yes, and it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And they wanted me, on the basis of my having read that, to join them at their church. And I asked them, have you read the Gita?
Yeah.
And they hadn't, and they were astonished that I would even ask such a question.
Right.
But
when they just did it to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what was fascinating to me was that they had never, they would not even consider the possibility of reading a book other than their own.
Right.
And that, I don't know how you could say my way is better than your way if you know nothing about my way.
Yes, exactly.
Know? So, yeah.
Exactly.
But we have no process for conversion. You will never find me waving pamphlets at your doorstep.
So, on the street corner.
No, that will not be me.
Yeah, and so that's really the point. As far as why, it's I identify as a Christian. I know there's some people that say, no, John, you're not a Christian, and that's okay. They can say that if they want to, you know. But I believe Christianity is a lot bigger path than a lot of people do, than the fundamentalist evangelical path that we see so popularly in this country. I believe that Christianity is a bigger path, and while somebody who is very fundamentalist as a Christian would say there's no point in exploring other religions, other faith paths. When you look at the mystics, you know, like Thomas Merton, I love Thomas Merton, and he explored. You know, he actually met with Gandhi, right? Thomas Merton did. You know, and I think that's absolutely fantastic. He was very much, and he was on more of a mystical path, not a very rigid, structured path. You know, although he had a lot of structure in his life, also. You know, but when you see a more of a mystic path, and you can see more of a unity, and you can see God as bigger than what fits inside your own little box. I think it's just absolutely beautiful. So it's not about conversion. It's about learning. And I know for me personally, by learning about how other people relate to God, I have found more peace and clarity on my own path. And that's been the big difference for me in exploring other religions and doing interfaith work.
Mm-hmm. I've read Sufi teachings and... Yeah. As Thomas Merton is a hero for me too, and a lot of mystical Christian poets, and I honestly don't see I don't mean to sound critical, but it's you can't confuse the path for the destination. So the experience of God, I think, is what unifies us.
Yeah.
But you can't assume that the experience is the same as the path to that experience.
Or that you can even put the experience... The problem with experience is, how do you put experience into words?
You can't.
So sometimes the words are just completely... I mean, especially our English language, you know, it's so coarse at times, you know. And there's things that I know and I feel and I believe and I experience that I cannot put into words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... That's the reason. The reason specifically why I wanted to do an episode on Bhagavad Gita is because I felt drawn to this text, and I saw, actually you guys know that I go to half price books and whole lot, and I get books and I give away books to people on this podcast. If you want to get some free books, go to reclaimingchristianity.net and click on free books. I would love to give some books to you. But I found a few copies of Bhagavad Gita, and it was a version of Bhagavad Gita. You guys know that in Christianity, our Bible is translated into many, many different versions. We have the New International Version and the King James Version and the New Living Translation and all these different things. So I found this version called Bhagavad Gita As It Is. And it was a translation, but you're going to have to say the name of the person.
Srila Prabhupada.
Yes, that. I could practice that for an hour and probably still not say it right, you know. But it was it said on it that it was the most popular version, and I think it was maybe translated in the 60s, around the time that the Beatles mm-hmm. were bringing some of these things mm-hmm. to the United States. And it said it was the most popular version that was in print in the United States. And so I'm like, oh well, I want to get that and I want to read it. And I had no idea what I was reading. It completely floored me. I felt completely confused. The way that he wrote, you could tell he knew what he was talking about, but I didn't know what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so you recommended to me another translation. And this is a translation. I think it's just called Bhagavad Gita is the title of it. And the name of the translator is, you're going to have to
Eknath
help me with that.
Eknath Ishwaran.
Eknath Ishwaran.
Mm-hmm.
Did I, was I even close on that one?
Mm-hmm.
Eknath Ishwaran.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. So I read this, and it was much more accessible. I was able to get into it some, and especially in the introduction to this, mm-hmm. I thought it was absolutely fantastic because it really hit me where I was as somebody just starting out on this journey, trying to find out what Hinduism it even is and what it says. And he really speaks into a lot of things, and he pulls in things from the Christian mystics who mm-hmm. I'm familiar with and brings in a lot of those concepts in that way. And I thought it was fantastic. So what I want to do with it on this episode is those of you listening, maybe you've been at the same place that I am and you say, well, I've wanted to read Bhagavad Gita, but I felt that same way. I was lost in it, you know. So I want to give you some tools to look at this text and start reading it a little bit. So some of those tools, there's a few terms that we have to talk about, okay? Mm-hmm. So the first term, and I mispronounced this once already, the term for Godhead.
Brahman.
Brahman. Mm-hmm. Brahman. Okay. So there's a quote that I loved out of the introduction to this book mm-hmm. That I want to read here and just comment on this. Tell me what you think of this or anything else you want to say about Brahman. Mm-hmm. From the earliest times, Hinduism has proclaimed one God. While accommodating worship of him or her, for millions God is the Divine Mother, in many different names. Now that especially struck me because the only thing, you know, coming from a Christian background, the only thing that Christians tend to know about Hinduism is you're polytheist. Everything is God. And and so this idea from the earliest times, Hinduism has proclaimed one God while accommodating worship in many different names. That was very interesting to me. What do you think about that?
You will find this in the Hindu temple here in Indianapolis.
Uh-huh.
The right at the entrance, you will find the statement, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahuta Vatanti. There is only one truth.
Okay.
People talk about it differently.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean there are so many truths, but then our understanding of the truth is from various perspectives. So we can talk about it very differently. Just as I know a person, somebody else knows the same person, but his understanding of this person will be different from my understanding.
Yeah.
So this is how, you know, we relate to God. There is only one God, but then we relate to him in our own ways.
Yeah. So even saying we relate to him.
Or her.
Yeah.
Or it.
I mean, that's a limitation of English right there, right?
Yes.
Because we don't have a personal pronoun that is gender neutral.
No.
Okay. So actually that even brings up another issue. Personal pronoun. Is God personal in a Hindu view?
Could be, you know, it depends upon how you want to relate to him.
Okay.
Suppose I think of him as my father.
Yeah.
I would relate to him as a father figure. Or I can relate to him as a mother. Or I can relate to him as a king.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, or I can relate to him as a child. Child I can adore and love.
Mm-hmm.
So, there are so many ways, you know, you can relate to a person or to the Godhead, you know, in so many forms. All of them are acceptable.
Hmm.
As long as you truly believe in what you are saying.
So in this book, in Bhagavad Gita, we know in Christianity, we see God in Jesus Christ. You know, we see the incarnation of God in the person of Jesus Christ. And so there's something similar to that in this story with the two main characters in this are Arjuna. And Krishna.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and Krishna is God, and Krishna comes in the form of a king that Arjuna is speaking to. Am I saying that right?
Mm-hmm.
Krishna okay. comes as a charioteer.
A charioteer. Yes, charioteer.
For Arjuna, who is a king.
Okay.
Now, the metaphor is that God is the charioteer.
Uh-huh.
For each of us. And now we are seemingly in control of this chariot, but then he's the one who is taking us where we should be going.
Hmm. A divine guidance,
divine
a leader.
Divine guidance, yeah.
That's interesting.
So the whole story is, the Gita is where how the charioteer instructs you what your path is and how you should go about it. And so on. So
the picture, I guess I didn't even get this picture before. So if Krishna is the charioteer, then he's driving. You know, it's and Arjuna is just in, you know, just a passenger.
He's the passenger.
Okay, okay. That makes a lot of sense. That's interesting. So God is my chauffeur.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So another term.
This metaphor was first mentioned in a famous scripture called Kathopanishad.
Okay.
Upanishad. It's one of the Upanishads.
Uh huh.
That's where this picture is drawn. You will find in many books of Krishna seated and holding the reins of the chariot.
Uh-huh.
And the king Arjuna, you know, is seated behind him. And Krishna is looking back at him and then talking to him.
Yep.
So this is a metaphor when the was first explained by in Kathopanishad that the chariot is our body. The charioteer is Krishna, and the one who in the chariot, now that's we as a soul.
That's very interesting.
And these horses are like senses which drag us everywhere. But then we need somebody, you know, to control those horses. Okay,
yeah.
Give it the reins in the hands of God, and he will guide you to wherever you want to go.
So in pop Christianity, like a bumper sticker Christianity, you may have seen the bumper sticker, God is my co-pilot,
yeah.
Right? That's so you're saying, no, God's the pilot.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If God's a co-pilot, you got problems. All right, that makes sense. So another term is Atman. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Atman is the divine core of personality. The quote that I really got from the introduction to this text, I have described the discovery of Atman and Brahman, God immanent and God transcendent, as separate, but there is no real distinction. Atman is Brahman. The self in each person is not different from the Godhead. Mm-hmm. So talk about that a little bit. So Brahman is God. And Atman is the self, and there's a link in there.
We usually say Atman is the self with the little s,
And
Brahman is the self with the capital S.
Okay.
That all of us are manifestations of that Brahman.
One of the verses in Bhagavad Gita is where Krishna says, Aham Atma Gudakesha Sarva Bhutase Sthitaha. I am situated in the heart of every living entity.
Uh-huh.
I am the beginning, I am the middle, I am the end. In all that exists. Okay. So God is the heart of everything that exists. And so he is the one who is guiding us.
Yeah. So there's a lot of passages in Christianity, the ones that really resonate with me, talking about mystical type Christianity. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about when I say those words, like in the book of John starts out, the other three gospels start out with a birth story. Oh, here's how Jesus was born. And the book of John starts out, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And it sets up this big celestial being, you know, and it says, oh, Jesus is not just this person, but Jesus is the incarnation of what existed before everything and what is in everything and through everything. The Apostle Paul talks many times about a God who is in and through and with. You know, and there's he used some famous poetry of their time, just to talk about how God is in everything and with everyone, and we may not know it, you know. And these are ideas that are within Christianity, but we've kind of pushed them to the side a little bit.
One of the things, you know, when I read the Book of John,
yeah,
was how close it was to the hymn of the origin.
Yeah.
The whole idea of God being present in every element of creation, that was very much a concept that's in the Vedas as well.
Mm. Yeah, the phrase that I was trying to think of, and I lost my train of thought, in him we live and move and have our being. I mean, that sounds like very similar to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. In God, we live and move and have our being. We are in God, and God is in us. I've heard a Christian mystic say, we are in God as fish are in water. And that's beautiful to me.
That's total.
Yeah, that's beautiful to me. Couple other concepts, the concepts of dharma and karma. You know, and I know there's a pop concept in the United States of America of karma. You know, we know karma is, you know,
out to get you.
Yeah. You know, I remember the TV show My Name Is Earl. Do you remember that in the 1990s? There was a sitcom where it was Jason Lee was basically, I'll say the term, trailer trash, mm-hmm. You know, and he won the lottery and he learned this concept. He won the lottery and then he lost his ticket or something like that. And he found the concept of karma through Carson Daly. And so the whole sitcom was him doing good things for others so that the karma would come back to him. You know, I mean, and it's all so the way that I've even begun to understand it, you know, that's selfishness. If you talk about I'm doing good things to other because I want good things to happen to me, and that doesn't really fit the concept of karma, okay? So talk about that a little bit.
I think two things that I, from my understanding anyway, one is that actions have consequences, and those consequences stick to the person who does them. Mm-hmm. So if you go out seeking rewards, then those rewards you would hope would eventually stick to you. And if you go out and you seek harm on others, then that harm sticks to you. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do you get unstuck? How can you be free of this? The other way that I at least understand karma is that you have to look at your life as a purposeful existence. So everything that happens to you isn't just randomly happening. It's actually giving you an opportunity to work out mistakes that you've made in the past, to where you have lacked compassion, to be more compassionate, where you have denied or not been aware of the presence of God in the people or the world around you, now you have that chance to recognize it.
Yeah.
So what happens in your life is a purposeful redressing of failures in the past. Hmm. And that's how I look at karma, is a way of moving forward in your life and assuming that the events that happen to you are not just the random cruelty of an unthinking universe, but a purposeful shaping of you toward this union with God.
Hmm. More abstractly, karma is what's called willed action.
Uh-huh.
Action comes by your willing it. But this willing could be sometimes voluntary and sometimes involuntary. For example, if I'm trained to be a soldier, my reaction would be always to act with force to everything. If I'm brought up in a group of good people, my reaction will not be that, the situation will not be that violent. You know, I'll be try to be more compassionate. Depends upon how, in what conditions I've grown up. So the actions that we do are not all the time deliberate.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they are. Sometimes they are involuntary.
Uh-huh.
You mean they're habitual reactions.
Habitual reactions. So you say that I'm not going to react. That's totally false, you know, because you are still acting when you say I'm not going to react.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually acting. Okay, so Krishna says that inaction is not a choice. You cannot choose to be inactive because you are active all the time. So then, since you know willy-nilly you are going to be acting, how do you act? How do you know that what you are doing is good or bad? This is the dilemma which Arjuna faces, because this is where the chariot is telling him how to do that. So action is called karma, any action, voluntary or involuntary. If it is willed action, the consequences will come to you. If they are not willed, still its action should still come to you. You cannot escape the consequences of karma. So liberation is therefore the goal. How do you liberate yourself from this situation? That is significant for today. Now how do you finally do it? Okay, so this is the final answer which Krishna gives for all the confusion that we may have. We need to surrender to God totally. And then do all our actions as dedication to God. So whatever you do, this I do as a dedication to the Lord. Then and now the consequences will not affect you. Don't go for fruits. Okay, I did good, therefore some good thing should happen to me. If you go with that idea and start doing good, you are accumulating certain merits, but those merits are very temporary.
Yeah.
They're not going to stick to you.
That's why Earl had how many episodes?
Yeah, I know. Well, I think karma eventually caught up with that series too. Spill the water. So that's the thing that really got me, because when we think about, like, in Christianity we call it sowing and reaping. You know, whatever you sow, that you also shall reap. You know, whatever you plant, you'll also harvest that. You know, and so that is a concept that's very much in Christianity as well. But the idea that really got me from the intro to this version of the Gita that we're talking about is where it was talking about the mental activity really matters also with the karma.
The intention,
you know, the intention. Yes. Yeah, most definitely. Now, some of what you were talking about also, if I understand it right, there is a difference between karma and dharma. So karma is that cause and effect. The dharma is more like the nature of a thing, you know, like the dharma of a soldier, you know, is to be a soldier and perhaps make war or violence. The dharma of a hammer is to pound nails into something, you know. So it's kind of the nature of something. Is that correct?
That's correct, too. Reason is... all of us should have the same feelings, ideas about everything. See, goodness should be common to all of us. Why is it some of us feel that so-and-so is not good? We are better than them, that kind of feeling.
Yeah,
why,
right.
Why should there be differences of goodness or perceptions of goodness that we have? Now, this is inescapable. Somehow there is an imbalance in nature. Gita points out that it's really so. This nature is called prakriti. Okay, you might have come across this word. Now here, everything should be balanced, because everything should be there, because it encompasses everything. But still there is somehow a balance is reached there, and something causes imbalance in this situation. Very much so, even in physics, they have found out now that there are things like matter and antimatter. The theory is that for every matter that's created, there's a corresponding antimatter.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to have balance, then both of them should be, and the same quantity should be there. But there seems to be a slight excess of matter in the whole universe. That is why there is creation. It's because of these differences we are born, and that's how we behave, and that's how the life continues on Earth. So this imbalance is very important to understand. And the fact that it is there should not discourage us. That's how, you know, we are going to sustain life. Okay. So we are not going to be discouraged by looking at, okay, there are bad people around. Okay. Eventually, everything will work out okay. So that is the assurance which Bhagavad Gita gives us, that we are driven by our propensities. Okay. These drive us to do things which we don't intend to do, but then somehow we end up doing those things. The consequences are going to be part of us. So we are going to be living with that. But why should it happen? Why should God create evil, etc.? But the reason is that's how it is. So there's no answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. It's a bigger question than we can understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your words reminded me of something. This is kind of a rabbit trail, but I'm going to go down this rabbit trail because it's interesting to me, and I think it'd be interesting to some of the people listening to this. So in Christianity, because I talked to you a little bit before and talked about how fundamentalism is really kind of entrenched in Christianity in the United States, and so many of us are more fundamentalist than we really think that they are. And so there's a divide with science and religion in Christianity. And like that, I don't know if you're familiar with the name Ken Ham. But Ken Ham is a young earth creationist. So he literally believes that the world was created 6,000 years ago. You know, and it was by the voice of God, 6,000. I'm not making this up. I am not making this up. Because when you trace and you're very literal with the words of the Bible, that's about where you come out to with the number of years that it comes into. And he believes that the world was literally created in 7 days. And he not just believes it, and there's many people, many Christians that believe this. But not only he believes this, but he has a creation museum that's in Kentucky, and it teaches this, and he goes so far as to say, if you don't believe in a literal 6-day creation, then you don't believe that Jesus Christ was God. You know, he takes it that far. And so what you were just saying about physics and some of the things that I've read also, there's very, very common in Christianity for people to choose between science and their faith. To get to a certain point in understanding science and think, well, I've got to either shift in my faith so it's not this fundamentalist understanding anymore, or I've got to choose not to go down that, and I'm not going to believe this science path, which is what Ken Ham has done. He said, I'm not going to believe what science is saying. I'm going to believe this over here instead. And from what you're saying, I believe, and also some things that I've read, you don't have this problem in Hinduism.
No.
There's some very, very smart, some top minds in physics that are Hindu, and they don't abandon their faith.
No, in fact, I would say that their science fuels their faith.
Yeah.
Because what they see in science, what they see in the patterns and in the balances of nature is the hand of God. Mm. So we don't see science and spirituality as fundamentally opposed to one another.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, okay, there may be people who believe that the earth was created 6,000 years ago and in 7 days, all of those things, does it make them kinder?
Yeah.
Does it make them more peaceful?
That's so good.
And if it does, then by all means, embrace that belief and go with it, because ultimately the world was created whenever it was created. But we have to live in this world.
Yeah.
And what matters is what we bring to it. So if it makes you kinder,
yeah,
go ahead.
And unfortunately, the answer to that usually is no, it does not make you kinder. It makes you entrenched, it makes you dig in, and it makes you set up walls, you know, and that's very frustrating. That's a big part of the reason why I'm doing this podcast, you know, that why I try to reclaim Christianity from this fundamentalism.
Well, I was just going to say, maybe they don't need to feel defensive about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
If you believe that, by all means, believe it.
Yeah, that's good. So these four terms, Brahman is God,
mm-hmm.
Atman is self, and these two are interlinked.
Just God and you.
God and you, mm-hmm. and these two are interlinked. Dharma is the nature of a thing, mm-hmm. and karma is cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Okay, so let's, so down to the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. So one common misunderstanding is going to be the Bhagavad Gita is the Hindu Bible. So why are you laughing? Why is it not the Hindu Bible?
Well, I don't think the Hindu faith is as monolithic in nature that one book is going to encompass everything that Hinduism is.
But that book encompasses quite a lot of aspects of Hinduism. So it unifies many branches of Hinduism.
It's not the first. It's not the first sacred text.
Well, this is what happened was there were so many texts, religious texts.
Yeah.
Some preceptors came and then they tried to unify them in some form or other.
So you mentioned the Upanishads.
Yeah.
There's the Vedas. Vedas.
The Vedas.
Okay.
And then the Puranas.
Okay.
And the Itihasas.
So we're talking about thousands of pages.
Thousands and thousands of pages, yeah.
Okay.
And then...
So this is not, you're gonna read all the Hindu scriptures in a year.
You know,
you're not going to sit on...
No.
That's what we try to do. That's a Christian thing. You say, I'm going to read through the Bible in a year.
That's not possible. Yeah. Even if it's possible,
yeah.
you will not make anything out of it. So you need somebody, you know, who has got the intuitive ability to see what is the essence of these things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, physics, and there are many, many experiments that were done. But then there was one person who was needed, like Newton, to come and give some laws.
Yeah.
Say, okay, most of the physics that we know can be expressed through these three laws. And then later now, when they found that these laws were not enough to encompass all the physics that you know, then Einstein came along and then gave his own idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a genius who is sitting in Oxford.
Stephen Hawking.
He has given his own idea. In fact, there are so many ways, you know, you can unify scattered experiences in physics into some common ground. The same way, in the case of the religious movement in India, many preceptors came and then tried to put together these books in some perspective. So Gita was one of the things which attempted that. And then many later preceptors came and then tried to put Gita and other things also in some context.
Mm-hmm.
So in this way, we have so many ways of looking at the teachings that we find in Hinduism.
So is there some kind of a hierarchy of the books? Like Iswaran says, did I say that right? Iswaran said in the beginning of his book, he said that the Bhagavad Gita is India's most important gift to the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so why does Bhagavad Gita stand out among the texts?
Because it's one which encompasses many of these texts I talked about.
I think the other thing is that many of those texts that we're talking about may seem very abstract.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the Gita is all about how do you live?
Hmm.
How do you live in a world where the choices are murky? You know, where the consequences of what you do, you don't fully know.
Hmm.
You know, how do you make your way to appropriately act in that world?
Hmm.
You know? And I think
that doesn't bind you to a church, doesn't bind you to a particular way of belief.
Mm-hmm.
This is what, you know, the Prabhupada group movement that Indu talked about, that's what they're trying to do is not to make Gita the focus of what were there, because that's one book which is available everywhere, has been translated in many languages.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of those books which was published by the Oxford University Press, you know, that's how it became well-known all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now you find that even Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is has been published by Macmillan
mm-hmm.
Company.
Hmm.
So these books have become, therefore, talking point for many people who won't understand Hinduism.
Sure.
So Ishwaran's statement that Bhagavad Gita is the book, which, because a lot of people have talked about it, so it's a good way of understanding what Hinduism is.
I think it's also, it was very much Mahatma Gandhi's textbook.
Yeah.
It was very much the, clearly it's very central to his Ishwaran himself. It's a very central teaching. The other thing is, I think I've seen that many people, many scholars have tried to find the parallels between the Bhagavad Gita and one particular aspect of the Bible, the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. Because again, Sermon on the Mount is that, how do you live? That's what the question is, right? How do you live intentionally? And in a way that propagates love. And that's what the Gita is about as well.
There's a past president of India. His name is Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan. You might have heard about him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a professor in Oxford University. And there he wrote a commentary on the Gita. In fact, a very beautiful written book. In fact, people who love the English language, because he is a master of expression when it comes to expressing himself through English.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an introduction about 40, 50 pages in that book. That's absolutely marvelous for me. Because
the introduction to this book is pretty marvelous, too.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, I highly recommend anybody who has even thought about getting into Bhagavad Gita, or even if you've never thought about it before and you're like, oh, well, this sounds kind of interesting, pick up this version. Pick up this version by all means. There's a line that Ishwaran says at the beginning. He says, the very heart of the Gita's message is to see the Lord in every creature and act accordingly. Does that sound about right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'd like to dig into some passages, to dig into something. You have some sample passages we can look into. So So the overarching thing is we've got these two main characters, Arjuna and Krishna, and Krishna is the charioteer, Arjuna is a prince, and about to go to war, and it's to go to war with his family, his relations in some way, in another area, and he's very uneasy about this. And so the whole thing is this conversation between Arjuna and Krishna.
Well, they've exhausted every diplomatic way to resolve the conflict between two sides of this family. And ultimately, they have come to this war. And on the first day of the battle, Arjuna is driven out onto the battlefield with Krishna as his charioteer.
Yeah.
And Arjuna looks on both sides and he sees his own family. He sees his friends. He sees that regardless of which side you're on, you're going to lose in this battle. And actually, his teachers, that all of these people are going to die. And he throws down his bow and his arrows. Can see them down here in the corner.
Yeah, they've got this lovely picture they've been showing me. I haven't referred to it. I love that you're showing that to me, but on a podcast, it's hard to...
Anyway, he throws down his bow and his arrow, and he says, I will not fight. Mm-hmm. And that is when Krishna turns around to him and explains to him that he cannot choose not to act. And then comes the whole discourse. And Arjuna keeps asking questions because he's filled with doubt. And Krishna, he has known all his life as his friend, his kinsman, his mentor. And he feels very comfortable in speaking to him about the things that, you know, many of us will hide, the doubts, the wavering in our faith. Those are things we may never speak of to anybody, and especially to someone whom we respect. But yeah. He feels that he can ask these questions. And finally, when Krishna tells him, this is your destiny to do this, and you are, if you can do this, if you can fight this war without any feeling of in yourself of anger or of self-will, if you can do this purely as a dedication to me and for the good of the world.
Laying aside the self.
Yes.
Laying aside desire.
Exactly. If you can say that you're not asking for any rewards from this, then no sin will accrue to you. And even then, with all of this assurance, Arjuna is still mired in a sea of doubt. Mm. And that is when Krishna reveals himself to Arjuna in his universal form as this towering figure of light with all the creatures of the world merging and emerging from him.
I've got to get to that part. That sounds awesome.
And Arjuna realizes there is nothing that is not part of God. There is nothing that is not part of Krishna. And the vision is just overwhelming. He actually asks Krishna to turn it off because you simply cannot retain a sense of yourself in the way that you've always thought of yourself if you are forced to think of yourself in this way as a part of God.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that finally convinces him that he needs to go forward.
See, that's fantastic. I mean, that shows. See, I haven't gotten that far into the story yet. That's wonderful, I immediately draw parallels between the characters of Moses, and Moses had this relationship in you know the first five books of the Bible. Moses had this relationship with God, whereas he talked with him and walked with him, and he could not see God. He could not see the face of God, you know, because no man can see the face of God and live. You know, so this same type of thing, that same type of reference, are also in the biblical book of Job. You have this same kind of dread happening because all of these bad things are happening to Job. Job loses all of his children, all of his great wealth, you know, and everything happening to him, and he cries out, and he keeps holding his faith, and he cries out, and nothing will stop it except for seeing God, and God shows himself to him at that point. The same type of a concept. This is what really excites me in hearing these stories, because these threads are woven through all these different religions. They really are. Mm-hmm. We have more in common than we have different. That's beautiful to me. So let's look at a specific passage. There was a passage you wanted to look at. We might have time to look at two passages briefly, but one in some sort of depth. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a choice of which one you wanted to do?
I will go with your choice. Okay. You're the expert, not me.
not an expert. by any means, but for me, the one that I especially liked was They Live in Freedom. So they live in freedom who have gone beyond the dualities of life. Mm. Competing with no one, they are alike in success and failure and content with whatever comes to them. They are free without selfish attachments. Their minds are fixed in knowledge. They perform all work in the spirit of service, and their karma is dissolved. The process of offering is Brahman. That which is offered is Brahman. Brahman offers the sacrifice in the fire of Brahman. Brahman is attained by those who see Brahman in every action.
So once again, if you're listening and you're hearing that word Brahman over and over, remember that this is God. This is the spirit of God is Brahman. So the process of offering is God. That which is offered is God. God offers the sacrifice in the fire of God. God is attained by those who see God in every action. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful to me.
In fact, that's the prayer that we say as grace, that verse, that that the act of offering, the fire in which the offering is accepted, the that this is God in you, you know? It's a good thing to remember.
So we have this word that we use, like if anybody's ever taken a yoga course, you know, you say namaste. Mm-hmm. Namaste. What is namaste?
Namaste is a gesture of prayer. It's literally, I mean, you put your hands together like you're praying, and you say namaste, and what you're saying is, that which is divine in me greets that which is divine in you. Mm. So when you greet someone, you're acknowledging their divinity.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's just such a beautiful idea. The divine in me reaches out, greets the divine in you. You know, and that's once again, this is something that very much is within Christianity. Also, you know, we talk about the divine spirit, the spirit of God, or even in the Old Testament, it says God has poured out His spirit upon all flesh. You know, I mean, it's just such a beautiful picture.
It was we went to a service in a French church in Paris at Saint-Denis, and it was Mass, and during that Mass. There's a point when you're supposed to turn around and greet the person next to you.
Uh-huh.
And you say, Du Christ, in Christ, we are one. And I thought, yes, I know this.
That's beautiful. So at the beginning of that passage, they live in freedom who have gone beyond the dualities of life. So it seems like there's something leading up to this.
Mm.
The dualities of life. What does that mean, the dualities of life?
To put it in very, very simple terms. If what are the first two words every toddler learns after mommy and daddy?
Is me.
And the other one is?
You.
No.
No. Okay.
Right? You have children always saying no.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We tend to divide things in our minds. From a very early age, we learn to say me and not me. We divide all of the world into me and not me, you know. And to some extent, that's a useful thing to do. It's to understand that some things are yours and some things are not, is you know, very basic understanding of ethics. But ultimately, you have to get beyond this sense of me and not me. I mean, I can say me and many Republican candidates for president, and that feels, you know, pretty spot on for me.
Yeah.
But to say me and, you know, the victims of the hurricanes in Puerto Rico, are they different from me? No, that doesn't feel that. That doesn't feel right to me. You know, there is certainly something in us that tells us that you are one with those who suffer.
Hmm.
So we have to get past this idea of me and not me. The other thing is that we tend to divide the world into the things that are pleasant, the things that we say yes to.
Yeah.
And the things that are unpleasant, the things that we have deemed unpleasant. And those things can also be what we might call evil, right? Not simply that, I don't mean to say that evil, what we see as evil is necessarily just things that are unpleasant to us. But we have this tendency to divide our experiences that way.
Yeah.
And to judge people that way. And you are not free of these habitual reactions that you that may drive your actions, okay? If you are caught in these dualities of this is me, this is what I know about me, and therefore this is what I do. I mean, I think this is what you're saying about, you know, the kind of blinkers that people put on themselves when they have decided that they have to be part of one particular path.
Yeah.
You're not really free. Your actions cannot be free in those terms.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, there's a philosopher named Peter Rollins who I love listening to. One of the things that he said that really struck me was he was talking about when we listen to a viewpoint. This is what we tend to do in our Western mindset, especially in the United States, especially when it comes to things like politics and religion. We tend to listen first. We listen just long enough to see if we agree or disagree. And then we start building our case either for or against it. You know? And what he says, what he wants us to do, and this sounds like a very Hindu concept, what he wants us to do is just suspend judgment. Drop all that and just let the ideas disturb you. You know, after that, you can accept the ideas or reject the ideas. That's okay, you know, but don't accept or reject them too early, because then you haven't really given them any kind of a chance.
There's a saying in the Vedas that says, let noble thoughts come to us from every side.
That's good. Yeah, when you talk about the dualities, you said, can I see myself in those hurricane victims in Puerto Rico? You know, I mean, I think there's many of us, especially on a progressive type side, where we can see ourselves. We say, I want to stand with those victims in Puerto Rico. I want to stand with the downtrodden. I want to stand with the oppressed. But what we have a hard time doing is saying, I see myself also in the oppressor. I see myself also. I would have a really hard time saying I am one with this power structure that oppresses the same way as I am one with those that are being oppressed.
And that's where, you know, you get into this escalating cycle of defensiveness and violence, because if you see yourself as simply out to overturn the authority, then the authority feels the need to fight back. And I think what Gandhi did was he said, we want the English to leave, but we want them to leave as our friends, right? So what he did, the acts of civil disobedience that he did, like the salt march, like the wearing of homespun cloth, it really showed people in government in England that what they were doing didn't match up with their own values, you know?
Yeah.
That they couldn't ethically justify their rule in India, and that really was the end of it.
Yeah, that's so good. So, got a little bit of time left here. I got two different places if you would want to go. Either another passage, or if you have a story that you would like to tell. I know I kind of put you on the spot before, but you've told a couple stories already. You know, I sit here and listen. I want, you can see me just staring and going, you know, I just want to sit at your feet and hear you tell stories. I think it's beautiful the way you do so. But if there's a story you want to tell, or if there's another passage you want to get into.
So one story which Bhagwan Satya Sai Baba told is this one.
Uh-huh.
We want to, this in relation to what Indu was just talking about, something being good, something not being good, and so on. Now we can't decide at all which is good and which is bad. Baba tells the story of Arjuna and Krishna meeting after the war is over, and then a few years later they talk to each other.
Yeah.
And then Krishna asks, what's going on in the world? And did not I establish, because one of the verses there said, I come from time to time to the world to establish righteousness. Okay, the world descends into unrighteous behavior. I come to put it back on course. So now what has happened is I find there are still people who are doing unrighteous things, and are thriving. And Krishna says, well, I don't know what is it, what you're talking about. Let us show you some instances. So Krishna takes him to, Arjuna takes him to a poor man's hut. He has nothing to eat, and he has a very lean cow. The cow also cannot give much milk. And all the time, you know, he's saying, oh Lord Krishna is praying to him. See, here is a devotee who is all the time praying to you, but you are not blessing him at all. He's held in poverty. So why don't you bless him? Krishna says, do you really want me to bless him? Yes. All right, Krishna says, I bless you. And then he walks away. Then Arjuna finds to his horror that the only cow that was there in that house, that was false dead. And then Krishna has walked off, so he runs after him. And then Krishna says, well, you have asked me to correct something, I've already done it, so what else is the problem? There is a rich man who is oppressing a lot of poor people.
Yeah.
Now he's somehow thriving. I want you to punish him. Oh, you don't want to bless him? No, I want you to punish him. So he takes him to that place where that rich man is playing a game with a friend of his. So they're betting games. So they bet a lot of money against each other. At one stage, you know, this rich man who has won a lot of money from this fellow who was playing against him says, all right, now I'm going to make a final bet. I'll bid all my wealth against this throw. You also do the same thing. And then Arjuna tells him, see, this is the time to punish him. Hmm. Let him lose his bet. Krishna says, all right, I punish him. And then he throws the dice and then he wins. Mm-hmm. So Arjuna is really confused. You know. In fact, what he thought was a blessing turned out to be a curse. Mm-hmm. What he thought was going to be a curse turned out to be a blessing. Mm. And then they both leave. And a few years later, Krishna says, all right, what's happening in the world? Go and find out. So Arjuna goes. Then he finds a very calm place, an ashram. There's this old man who was so poor, he was sitting there. He's now very calm and composed. You know, he's very happy. People come and fall at his feet. Then I ask him, what has happened to you? He said, well, there's something happened to me which he thought was a curse, was really a blessing. I was depending, thinking that the cow is the only way thing that's protecting me.
Yeah.
And I was hoping that the cow should prosper. But when the cow died, then I find that all these things are not going to really help me. My only prop is the Lord.
Yeah.
So I became a person who had infinite faith in God, and that attracted a lot of people to me. Then he goes to a person who is, goes out and meets this rich man. Now he's sick and is dying. And then Arjuna goes and says, see, the Lord has punished you. No, he has not punished me. No, actually, he has blessed me. Because I was doing all sorts of atrocious things. And I came to such a feeling that nothing in this world can hurt me. Now I have lost everything. Hmm. But then I still have the fact that that thing which he thought was a blessing was not a blessing. Actually, it really put me in the proper path again. And then Arjuna goes back to Krishna and says, well, now I know that it's really wrong for me to judge what is right, what is good and what is bad. Hmm. The ultimate, see, what is good now may turn out to be the wrong thing for me. What I think is bad will turn out to be the best thing for me. So let me not judge these things anymore.
Hmm. Wow. That's how it is. Yeah. There's so often that we don't know. When we're within the moment, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen down the road.
So oftentimes you find that
the blessings might be curses. Yeah, the people, curses might be blessings.
Who you think should not win,
yeah,
they win, and then we feel okay. We lose faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
So should not lose faith.
Because ultimately, I mean, both the rich man and the poor man come back to this idea that there is no reality other than the presence of God in their lives.
Hmm.
You can't ask for more
There's
than
one
that.
One bhajan whether to sing, everything is a sign of your grace.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Indu and Venkat, thank you very much. Thank you very much for appearing here. It's been lovely just being in your home, and it's been lovely having you appear on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. So I'm going to close up here. If you are interested in Hinduism, if you're interested in Bhagavad Gita, there's some good tools there. The version that we looked in was by I'm gonna say his name wrong again here. I've lost it in my notes.
Ikna Ishwaran.
Ikna Ishwaran. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I'll put it in the show notes for the podcast also. If you're interested in that, go ahead and check it out. Look at it. You can engage with me. I would love to talk with you about the things that I'm learning about Hinduism or about other religions. And like I said, it's not about okay, now I'm going to be this. Now I'm going to be this religion. Now I'm going to follow this ideology. It's about following the spirit or the inner voice, the inner light, you know, and wherever that leads you to, and seeing that there are more similarities than there are differences. I think it's just beautiful. So coming up on the podcast, the next week, we're going to start off getting into the book Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God. This is a theology book by Brian Zond that talks about getting away from the angry God metaphors. If you'd like to be involved in one of those discussions, please hit me up on the podcast. Hit me up on my website, reclaimingchristianity.net. If you want to be involved in the book club and actually be a part of the discussion, just join that. You can go to reclaimingchristianity.net and click on book club, and that'll tell you how to get in there. Let's see, what else do we have coming up? If you would like to sponsor this podcast, there are costs associated with podcasts. If you'd like to be a sponsor, you can check out patreon.com/John Weldy. If you would like some free books, I love giving free books away to people. Good books, really good stuff. If you would like to get a free book or a couple free books, go to reclaimingchristianity.net and click on free books. And so one last thing that I will say to you before I sign off, same thing I say to you every week, friends, the most beautiful thing you can ever be is you. Do what you love what you do. Thanks for listening.